In the wake of the September 11 attacks, Americans abandoned air travel in droves, terrified by the visceral images replaying on their television screens. What nobody mentioned during this mass exodus to highways was a simple fact: flying remained dramatically safer than driving. This collective fear-driven decision had deadly consequences. In the year following 9/11, the shift from planes to cars killed 1,595 Americans, more than half the terrorist death toll. These weren't routine accidents. These deaths were stolen by fear itself. Franklin Delano Roosevelt understood this phenomenon when he famously declared, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." The Science of Fear by Daniel Gardner explores this profound paradox of modern life. Despite living in history's safest, healthiest, and longest-lived era, we're more afraid than ever. The book has become a cultural touchstone, praised by psychologists and behavioral economists alike for its accessible explanation of how our ancient brains navigate a modern information landscape. Bill Gates included it on his recommended reading list, noting how it illuminates the gap between perceived and actual dangers in our daily lives. Our brains evolved during the 2-million-year Paleolithic era when humans lived as hunter-gatherers, not in our current world of glass, steel, and digital information. This ancient wiring still dominates our thinking. As evolutionary psychologists note, we are essentially cavemen with smartphones. Our neural architecture remains virtually unchanged since our ancestors painted on cave walls. This mismatch between our ancient brains and modern environment creates profound challenges. Our minds contain hardwired responses that served our ancestors well, but frequently mislead us today. Consider the law of similarity, the assumption that things that look alike are alike. This rule helped our ancestors make quick judgments. If it looks like a lion, treat it like a lion. But leads modern humans astray when confronting photographs, videos, and digital representations that didn't exist until recently. Our minds operate through two distinct systems. System 1, gut, intuitive, quick, and emotional. And System 2, head, calculating, slow, and rational. Head represents conscious thought, analyzing statistics and making logical decisions, but works slowly and requires education. Gut makes unconscious, lightning-fast judgments that trigger physical responses like racing hearts when danger threatens. The interaction between these systems explains many quirks of human behavior. Head cannot directly access gut's reasoning, which is why focus group participants often rationalize their snap judgments with plausible but incorrect explanations. Knowledge can migrate from head to gut through practice, as when doctors internalize diagnostic skills until they become intuitive. But when we're rushed, tired, distracted, or stressed, head's monitoring becomes sloppier and gut takes control. This dynamic resembles a car with a caveman who wants to drive and a bright but lazy teenager who should keep a hand on the wheel but would rather listen to his iPod. When the teenager falls asleep, the caveman drives us straight into trouble, explaining why we make irrational decisions when afraid, tired, or emotional. Our unconscious mind relies on mental shortcuts called heuristics to make quick judgments about risks and opportunities. Three particularly powerful shortcuts shape our risk perception. The anchoring rule causes us to use the first available number as a starting point for estimations, regardless of its relevance. When uncertain about a quantity, gut grabs the nearest number as an anchor, and head adjusts insufficiently from there. This makes the anchoring rule valuable for marketers selling fear. When software companies cite 50,000 pedophiles online at any moment, even skeptical parents unconsciously use this number as an anchor, perhaps adjusting down to 10,000, still a frightening figure that feels right because they generated it themselves, not realizing it's merely an arbitrary adjustment from meaningless data. The rule of typical things leads people to judge elaborate scenarios as more probable than simpler ones when they contain plausible representative details, despite this being logically impossible. Kahneman and Fersky demonstrated this with experts who rated a Russian invasion of Poland followed by diplomatic suspension between USA and Soviet Union as 3 times more likely than just diplomatic suspension alone. This vulnerability to good storytelling explains why pundits' elaborate predictions are so appealing yet so frequently wrong. The example rule, or availability heuristic, means we judge frequency based on how easily examples come to mind. Memories become more available when they're emotional, concrete, visual, and feature human faces expressing emotion. Our memories aren't reliable records, but organic processes that routinely fade, transform, or even fabricate experiences. This memory bias creates paradoxes, like people buying earthquake insurance when risk is lowest, right after an earthquake, and dropping it as risk rises. These rules made perfect sense in our evolutionary environment, but become dangerous in our modern information landscape. With 7 billion humans and instantaneous global communication, any risk will manifest somewhere and be broadcast everywhere, making gut conclude we should fear everything from exotic viruses to terrorists to online predators. Our feelings influence decisions in surprising and often unconscious ways that shape our perception of risk and safety. The mere exposure effect, first documented by psychologist Robert Zions, demonstrates that simply being repeatedly exposed to something breeds familiarity and liking, a phenomenon that corporations exploit through advertising campaigns that increase familiarity with brand names, logos, and jingles. This effect is so powerful that even subliminal exposure can create positive associations. This psychological mechanism profoundly impacts risk perception across many domains. Consider someone raised in a tobacco farming community where chewing tobacco is commonplace. They develop positive emotional associations through years of seeing respected family members and neighbors use it, creating an unconscious positive bias that colors their assessment of its dangers. Their gut emotional system labels it as good and instinctively concludes good things don't cause cancer, even in the face of clear scientific evidence. Working with Ali Al-Hakami and other researchers, Paul Slovic developed what he termed the affect heuristic, what Daniel Gardner calls the good-bad rule. When we encounter anything, from new technologies to policy proposals, our emotional brain instantly generates a raw feeling, categorizing it as good or bad, which then guides subsequent judgments about benefits and risks. Laboratory experiments confirmed this effect. When under time pressure, which reduces the analytical brain's ability to modify emotional judgments, participants who read positive information about a technology not only raised their estimate of its benefits, but simultaneously lowered their perception of its risks, despite receiving no information about risks whatsoever. This emotional shortcut explains numerous risk perception puzzles, why cancer's lethality is consistently overestimated while diabetes is underestimated, why we fear nuclear power plants but readily expose ourselves to X-rays and prolonged sunlight. The good-bad rule operates through emotional labeling that occurs automatically and unconsciously, often without us experiencing any conscious emotion at all. Our emotional reactions to risks are also powerfully influenced by our innate sense of justice and attribution of blame. When a child drowns accidentally versus being beaten to death, both tragedies claim an innocent life, but only the murder provokes intense public outrage and demands for punishment. This primal urge to punish wrongdoing appears to be evolutionarily hardwired as a mechanism to discourage exploitation and maintain social order. Studies show that even infants as young as 6 months old show a preference for agents who punish antisocial behavior. The blame factor helps explain why radon gas, which kills approximately 41,000 people annually in the U.S. and EU combined, generates relatively little public concern despite extensive public health campaigns. Being a naturally occurring radioactive gas, radon lacks a clear villain to blame for its deadly effects. Natural dangers without human culprits simply don't trigger our evolved outrage response in the same way that human-caused dangers do. This psychological blind spot has real consequences, as many people fail to test for and mitigate radon in their homes despite its serious health risks. The breast implant crisis of the 1990s wasn't fundamentally about silicone chemistry or corporate negligence, but about our innate tendency to respond powerfully to stories while remaining unmoved by statistics. Personal narratives grab our attention in ways numbers never can. News of thousands dying in distant floods barely registers, while a single celebrity death instantly captures our focus. Similarly, the individual stories of women suffering after breast implants felt true and compelling, despite the lack of epidemiological evidence showing causation. This storytelling bias is likely evolutionary. Humans are hardwired to share personal stories as a form of social bonding, replacing the tick-picking behavior of other primates and as mental rehearsal for life's challenges. While stories connect us emotionally, they're an incomplete guide to truth. Humans are naturally poor with numbers. Neuroscientist Stanislaus Dehaene notes that while we share basic numerical abilities with animals like dolphins and rats, our innate capacity quickly falters with larger numbers. We're systematically slower to compute 4 plus 5 than 2 plus 3, and distinguishing between close quantities like 8 and 9 takes more effort than between 2 and 9. This innumeracy affects even educated people. A Canadian poll found 45% didn't know how many millions are in a billion. Without numerical literacy, people rely on gut reactions to information like 3 parts per billion of arsenic, knowing only that arsenic is dangerous without context. Numbers fail to make us feel. Proportions can influence our thoughts more than simple numbers. People supported airport safety equipment more when told it would save 98% of 150 lives than when told it would save 150 lives. We can't picture 150 lives, but we can feel proportions. Our intuition fails to grasp randomness. We expect random dots to be evenly dispersed, believe certain lottery number combinations are more likely, and fall for the gambler's fallacy. This leads to misperceptions about everything from basketball's mythical hot hand to flooding patterns to cancer clusters, where people reject statistical explanations in favor of intuitive ones. Despite our skepticism, we remain social animals powerfully influenced by what others think. Scientific information plays a role in risk perception, but public opinion can form through social cascades, where beliefs spread as people adopt the judgments of others. When faced with difficult and important judgments about risk, precisely the conditions under which conformity increases, people are more likely to follow the group view and feel confident doing so. Once we form a belief, regardless of how we acquired it, our brains automatically seek to confirm it. In Peter Wasson's classic experiment with number sequences, participants repeatedly failed to test their hypotheses by seeking disconfirming evidence. This tendency is neurologically hardwired. MRI studies show we actually use different brain regions when processing information that contradicts our strongly held views. When like-minded people discuss risks together, their views don't average out, they become more extreme. This group polarization occurs through two mechanisms: social comparison, people judge themselves by asking, "How correct am I?" and shift toward more extreme positions, and information pooling, where confirmation bias ensures only supporting information gets serious consideration. Social cascades form as Alan convinces Betty, who persuades Carl, and soon thousands believe they face mortal peril. These waves of worry follow social networks, and media amplify them through emotional stories, creating feedback loops where more fear generates more reporting, which generates more fear. Risk perceptions vary dramatically between cultures, shaped by worldviews rather than facts. Dan Kahan's research revealed that the white male effect in risk perception disappeared when accounting for cultural worldviews. Hierarchists and individualists, disproportionately white men, perceive guns as low risk, while communitarians and egalitarians see them as dangerous, reflecting cultural programming rather than objective assessment. When presented with balanced information about unfamiliar technologies like nanotechnology, people filter it through their cultural lens. Hierarchists emphasize benefits, while egalitarians focus on risks. We're not rational creatures objectively evaluating risks. We're tribal beings screening information to conform with cultural beliefs. The security industry thrives by marketing fear rather than rational risk assessment. At Security Essen, Germany's massive trade show, vendors hawk everything from electrified fences to bulletproof cars, surveillance cameras to anti-terrorism equipment. Their marketing rarely addresses actual statistics, instead depicting unlikely scenarios like morning home invasions and affluent neighborhoods. These advertisements trigger our intuitive brain's fear response through the good-bad rule and example rule, creating lasting emotional impressions that override rational analysis. Even when our analytical mind intervenes, the nagging worry remains, a perfect marketing tool. Pharmaceutical companies excel at subtle fear marketing, from seemingly innocent posters in doctors' offices that emphasize medication over lifestyle changes, to funding health organizations that blur the line between medical advice and sales pitches. Their economic interests require people to perceive themselves as unhealthy, regardless of actual physical state. Drug company spending on TV ads doubled to $1.19 billion between 2001 to 2005, with one-third spent on sleep medicines despite their relative insignificance compared to major causes of death. Research shows these ads rarely describe condition causes, 26%, risk factors, 26%, or prevalence, 25%, instead convincing viewers they might need medication. While 19% mention lifestyle changes alongside medication, none present them as alternatives, and some explicitly state lifestyle changes aren't enough. Fear marketers have long understood psychological principles that scientists are only now catching up with. Paul Slovak discovered tobacco industry marketing documents from decades ago that revealed sophisticated understanding of affect and System 1 gut thinking 20 years ahead of cognitive psychologists. Political campaigns deploy fear as effectively as corporations do. Ted Brader's research found that fear-based advertising significantly influences politically informed voters, contrary to assumptions that the less informed are more susceptible. Political consultants have long understood that visual context overwhelms verbal content. As Republican strategist Frank Luntz notes, a striking visual context can overwhelm the intended verbal message entirely. The media plays an essential role for every organization marketing fear. News outlets routinely distort risk perception through their coverage choices, consistently featuring unrepresentative cases that skew public understanding. Media consistently features unrepresentative cases that distort public risk perception. The Globe and Mail's cancer series prominently featured 3-year-old Shelby Gagne's heartbreaking story and beautiful portrait, despite her being a one-in-a-million case. This misrepresents cancer's reality. 60% of cancer deaths occur in people over 70, with less than 1% occurring before age 20. Images dramatically amplify risk perception beyond what text alone conveys. Research by Gibson and Zillman demonstrated this using a fictitious blowing rock disease. People who read articles with disturbing images of ticks and affected children estimated much higher risks than those who read text alone, despite identical factual information. Media routinely fails to address the essential question about any risk: how likely is it? Stories frequently mention that something could happen without providing meaningful context about probability. This denominator blindness occurs when media report that X people were killed without saying out of Y population, making it impossible to calculate actual risk. Media consistently report relative risk, twice the risk, without absolute risk, actual probability, creating misleading impressions. When the FDA announced women using the OrthoEvra birth control patch faced twice the blood clot risk of pill users, most newspapers omitted crucial context that this meant just 6 in 10,000 women might develop clots annually. The standard explanation for media fear-mongering is self-interest. Fear sells papers and boosts ratings. However, profit motive isn't the sole cause. Newsroom cutbacks mean fewer reporters doing more work with less time for investigation or verification. Most fundamentally, reporters themselves are human, drawn to dramatic, emotional stories that grab attention precisely because they trigger our innate storytelling instincts. Our storytelling instinct explains why media coverage bears little relation to actual risks. Stories about breast cancer routinely feature young women, despite most victims being elderly. It simply feels more tragic. The King's Fund study revealed British media overwhelmingly covered health service crises and novel health scares while ignoring the massive toll of smoking, alcohol, and obesity. Their death per news story ratio showed 8,570 smoking deaths per story versus just 0.33 deaths from mad cow disease. Despite widespread panic and inflated figures claiming tens of thousands of children are abducted annually, the reality is dramatically different. According to the National Incident Studies of Missing, Abducted, Runaway, and Thrown Away Children, NISMART, only 115 stereotypical kidnappings by strangers occur annually in America, about 1 in 608,696 children. For comparison, a child is 2.5 times more likely to drown in a swimming pool and 26 times more likely to die in a car crash. News media routinely invert the reality of crime. The media's crime pyramid is completely inverted from reality. Murder, representing just 0.14% of all U.S. crimes, dominates coverage, while property crimes, 88% of all crime, are largely ignored. Americans worry about murder at rates wildly disproportionate to actual risk. Only 0.0056% are murdered annually, three times fewer than die in car crashes. With media consistently misrepresenting crime, people develop distorted perceptions. Oxford criminologist Julian Roberts found most people believe violent crime accounts for about half of all recorded crime, wildly inaccurate. In one Ohio study, only 20% of respondents could estimate violent crime rates accurately, while a third overestimated by at least six times. People consistently believe crime is worsening despite evidence to the contrary. The 2005-06 British Crime Survey found 63% thought crime was increasing nationally when it had actually dropped 44% over the previous decade. Similarly, after seven straight years of plummeting U.S. crime in the 1990s, 47% of Americans still believed crime was rising. Our fascination with crime stories stems from evolutionary psychology. As Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert explains, humans are social mammals whose brains are highly specialized for thinking about others. For our ancestors living in small bands, understanding rule-breaking was crucial for survival. Crime stories particularly engage us because they combine our natural interest in other people with emotionally powerful narratives. Despite the statistical reality, nearly half of Americans remain worried about themselves or family members being killed by terrorists, a level of concern actually higher than 4 years after 9/11, despite no attacks on American soil. This disconnect stems from the Bush administration's framing of terrorism as acts of war and an existential threat, rather than as criminal acts by fanatics. The administration consistently amplified the danger, with Bush declaring terrorism part of a succession of struggles against Hitlerism, militarism, and communism, and officials like Michael Chertoff claiming terrorism posed every bit as much danger as previous global conflicts. This rhetoric prevented Americans from engaging their rational minds to evaluate the actual probability of harm. The risk of terrorism varies dramatically by location. In Israel, the lifetime risk of injury or death ranges between 1 in 100 and 1 in 1,000, high enough that most people will know someone affected. But elsewhere, this risk falls between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in a million. For perspective, an American's lifetime risk of death by lightning is 1 in 79,746. By venomous plants or animals is 1 in 39,873. By bathtub drowning is 1 in 11,289. By suicide is 1 in 119. And by car crash is 1 in 84. Despite fears of terrorists obtaining weapons of mass destruction, the evidence suggests this threat is overstated. Even Israel, the most targeted nation by terrorists with state sponsors, has never experienced a WMD attack. States hesitate to provide such weapons to terrorists, fearing both retaliation if discovered and loss of control over the weapons. Creating homemade WMDs requires advanced scientific training, significant financial resources, sophisticated facilities, rigorous testing capabilities, and effective dissemination methods, requirements beyond most terrorist organizations and even many nation-states. Despite his wealth and freedom in 1990s Afghanistan, bin Laden failed to acquire chemical weapons. Terrorists deliberately cultivate fear because it's their most effective weapon. As Brian Michael Jenkins explains, terrorism creates an atmosphere of fear and alarm that causes people to exaggerate the strength of terrorists and the threat they pose. Their weakness drives them to target innocents, the only attack available to feeble combatants. That world of constant danger is not ours. While we still know tragedy, diphtheria, once recognized by all, is now merely a word mentioned during childhood vaccinations. The 1923 vaccine virtually eradicated it across the developed world. This triumph joins many others: the extinction of smallpox, vitamin-fortified foods, and sewage disposal systems that may have saved more lives than any other invention. In 1725, American life expectancy was 50 years, relatively high for the time. By 1900, it had barely changed at 48 years. Then everything transformed. By 1950, it soared to 68, and by century's end, reached 78. Child mortality plummeted from 20% in 1900 to just 0.8% by 2002, with similar improvements worldwide. This unprecedented change isn't commonplace in human history. It's miraculous. The miracle continues unfolding. Nobel laureate Robert Fogel believes life expectancy gains in the coming century may match those of the past, predicting half of today's college students will live to 100. While other researchers are less optimistic, the World Health Organization projects continued improvements in life expectancy across all global regions. Despite remarkable improvements, fear defines our age. This paradox stems from historical ignorance and active fear marketing. Politicians, corporations, activists, and media bombard us with carefully crafted messages to make us worry. While we can't eliminate the circuitry of fear, our Stone Age brains, information technology, and incentives for marketing fear, we can reduce its volume through skepticism, information gathering, and careful thinking. We must recognize our cognitive biases, though this is difficult. Most people acknowledge others' biases while believing themselves immune. Even knowing about biases like the anchoring rule doesn't prevent them from operating, as they stem from our unconscious gut. The perception that we live in uniquely dangerous times is largely an illusion created by hindsight bias. Looking back, past threats seem more predictable and less frightening than they were. Thomas Friedman's 2003 belief that his daughter faced a more dangerous world than her 1985 birth date ignores that 1985 featured imminent nuclear war threats and AIDS panic. Despite this history, catastrophists rarely show humility. James Howard Kunstler predicted Y2K disasters in 1999, then published more dire predictions in 2004. Ehrlich has repeated essentially the same arguments for 40 years. Yet, as Martin Rees wisely notes, for most people in the world, there's never been a better time to be alive.